It is 7:30, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studio this morning, Jennifer Abbott. She is co-director and editor of the new film, The Corporation, which is showing this week and tonight at the Seattle International Film Festival. Jennifer, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having me.
If I could start out and ask you, what was the motivation for creating the film, The Corporation?
Sure. I should credit my co-director, Mark Akbar, and the co-creator and writer, Joel Bakken, with the genesis of the film. Around 7 years ago, they were actually at a rather sad occasion, the funeral of a friend's sister, a mutual friend's sister, and they were discussing the projects that they were working on. Mark had previously done Manufacturing Consent, Noam Chomsky in the media, a film many people know, and Joel is a law professor and Rhodes Scholar. Both were working on issues of globalization, and they sort of had this mutual epiphany where they said, you know, there's nobody that is focusing on the very institution of the corporation that's examining the corporation as the dominant institution of our day, which is sort of absurd considering how much power and resources and influence it has over society. And so they said, well, we really should develop a documentary about this.
And how did you get pulled into it?
In 1999, I was editing a project with Mark called Two Brides and a Scalpel, Diary of a Lesbian Marriage, a video diary about the first legally married lesbian couple in Canada. They were married as a heterosexual couple, and then one had a sex change and so became a lesbian couple. So I was working on that project with Mark at his studio in his house while the funds were being raised and the treatments were being put together for the corporation. Mark and I worked very well together. Politically, we share a lot of opinions, and I think we have a very similar film aesthetic. So I got pulled in as originally just as an editor, and then it became apparent through the process of consultation that I started doing that I was co-directing, and so I became a co-director as well.
All right, and one of the first things that comes up in the film is the pointing out establishing that corporations are legal persons. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. If we look at the first corporations or the original corporations in the States, as an example, they were created to serve the public good. They had much, much more strict regulation through state-issued charters. And really, they were conceived with the idea of being something, a force of good in society that would, as I said earlier, serve the public. About 150 years ago, corporate lawyers realized they didn't want so many external constraints. And they used the recently introduced 14th Amendment to gain legal personhood. You know, very cleverly, they realized that if they had the legal status of a person in court, then they would have many of the rights that they wanted and could operate more freely in society. And that was really the start of the corporation's rise to dominance.
And you take that in a wonderful direction, as corporations as persons, and you start going through these different facets of the corporation's personality. Can you talk about how you came up with that idea and what became of it?
Sure. Well, given that the corporation is a legal person, we then ask the question, well, what kind of person is the corporate person? And we basically put the institution of the corporation on the psychiatrist's couch and diagnose it. We go through a variety of case studies, and certainly there's no shortage of possible stories that we could have drawn from. And we conclude through a pretty rigorous analysis that the corporate person is actually psychopathic. Now, this might seem a little bit radical. It might, you know, for people that just hear that sentence, you know, oh my God, that seems a little crazy to think that. But you know, if you really look at the way that flesh and blood psychopaths are diagnosed and the criteria that you use, and then you compare that to the legal mandates of the corporation as an institution, it's uncanny the way that it meets the criteria of a psychopath.
And didn't you even include a fairly world-renowned, yes. What would you call it?
He's the world expert on psychopaths for the FBI, Dr. Robert Hare, and we visited with him. Very, very conveniently, he actually happens to live in Vancouver. We're from Canada, and that's where we work out of. So I should say that most of the 70 interviews weren't nearly as convenient. But yes, Dr. Robert Hare does make an appearance, and he contributes his extensive knowledge of psychopaths.
Talk about... say 70 interviews. That seems like a lot. How did you decide on those, and did you end up using all those?
Right. Well, it is a lot, and I think that really this project is a huge project. When you go out and make a film about the corporation today, you're really making a film about the world, because this institution is so dominant. But Mark and Joel and I, and sometimes Don Brett, who's our associate producer and researcher, sort of jointly decided who we would interview, and we would shape interview questions together as well. And I think, you know, when you're creating an issues-based or ideas-based documentary, it's really important to find the human stories and to find the emotional power in those stories. And frequently, I think that comes out through our interview subjects. And so in the terms of, you know, how did we go from 70 subjects down to 40, you know, the selects were made frequently in terms of how engaging a subject might be and or charismatic, or how intriguing a person, because I think that there are, no matter how good your ideas are, unless the documentary is engaging and entertaining and hopefully emotionally powerful, you know, people aren't going to want to watch it.
Now, the people that you did have in front of the camera, it was a wide range of people, mm-hmm. which actually surprised me. It was kind of like everyone from Vanda Nashiva to Milton Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the vision from the start, is to kind of get this full gamut of people?
Absolutely. And not only that, you know, I think that it's easy to get the Noam Chomskys of the world, or the Vanda Nashivas of the world, or the Naomi Kleins to critique the corporation, and that's what viewers expect. It's harder to get Milton Friedman or Ray Anderson, the CEO of the largest commercial carpet manufacturer, or, you know, other corporate insiders, Robert Monks, another interview subject, the past CEO of over 10 corporations. It's harder to get them to critique the corporation, but in some ways it's more meaningful to have corporate insiders make the most damning accusations of this institution. And I think that's actually what happens in the film, and part of the strength of the film.
So how did you manage to grab those people who are, you know, corporate heads of state?
How did we gain access to
them?
Yeah,
I mean, why would they cooperate with a film like this?
Sure. Well, I think that there's two kinds of CEOs out there, if I can be so bold and be so general. There's the CEO who recognizes that something is wrong, that there are problems with the system, and is open to listening, you know, about different perspectives on those problems. And then I think there's a kind of CEO that just says, nope, nothing's wrong, we won't even engage with this. And on the former, you know, in the former category, there's also the recognition that it's important to at least appear to be transparent as a corporation, to appear to be in dialogue with your critics. That's a good thing in terms of the corporate image. So, you know, we were able to gain access to a lot of corporate insiders who I think philosophically are in the former category. And every now and then we would, you know, open the door to the other kind. For example, Michael Walker from the Fraser Institute. The Fraser Institute is a right-wing think tank in Canada that's very much like the Cato Institute here. And Michael Walker is sort of the latter category, you know, not thinking things are wrong, and he's, you know, there are people like that in the film as well.
I remember one of the things, I can't remember who it was specifically, because there's like so much that you pack into this film. It's
yes.
What, about 2.5 hours? Is that?
Yes, right? Almost.
One of the guys who was doing kind of a spiel about his vision of what corporations are, and then at the end he said something like, oh, that's a bunch of baloney, or correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Sure. Well, we asked every interview subject what their metaphor is for the corporation, and that is part of the opening sequence of the film. And Ira Jackson from the Harvard School of Business, he gave the metaphor of an eagle, and you know, majestic, and you know, very poetically waxed about the eagle and how it was like it would be a good logo for the corporation. And then at the end, he says, "Okay, enough bullshit." And you know, that's Ira Jackson. He doesn't take, you know, I think he has that side to him. And anyway, it's a funny moment in the film.
Well, and that's something that really pulls the film together, and really, I think, helps convey a lot of these ideas, is your use of humor, which you put in generously into it. Could you talk about how one goes about doing that? I mean, how is the process that you guys go through to inject specific right. pieces of humor?
Well, I mean, I should say to start with that, you know, this subject is deadly serious. It's in the sense that I really think that it's not an overstatement to say that we're, you know, the way corporations are affecting the earth, you know, could result in the end of life as we know it on this planet unless some things change. So, you know, it's deadly serious. But that said, I think it's so important that we not just be buried in despair and feel weighty and hopeless. And so humor is a way to I think sometimes to deal with the most serious problems. For one, it enables one to not, you know, we can't take ourselves this seriously. We don't have all the answers. We're not pretending that we are on a pedestal and looking down and can see how everything should be. It's you know, I think humor injects some humility into this process and sort of says, you know, we as humans have the ability to laugh, and there's some things in here that are absurdly funny. How do humorous moments come about in the film? And that's a good question, and I think that's just part of the creative process. And for myself, I use archival footage to create humor frequently. And when I first view archival footage, you know, if I have a reaction that I find funny, I'll, you know, try it out. You know, and Mark Akbar, my co-director's process around humor is quite different. I'm more see something, try it, you know, more sort of spontaneously get an idea through the motivation of actually some source material. Mark, I think, spends a lot of time thinking, how can we make this funny? You know, he's not necessarily source-driven. He thinks a lot about that, and he's very, very... It was extremely important to him that there be humorous moments in the film.
Were you responsible for bringing in a lot of the archival pieces that are in the film?
Yes. We had a wonderful archival researcher named Paula Sawatsky, and so we would ask her to research certain things for us. And sometimes, you know, she would get exactly what we requested. And then other times, you know, she'd get that, but she'd also get something related or what have you. And probably in the end, I worked with about 100 hours of archival footage. Some of that Mark found as well. And, so I would figure out how we wanted to use that footage. And there it is.
So go into perhaps the mechanics, for lack of a better word. Describe how this whole film kind of mechanically comes together. I mean, you come up with the idea how you want to do this, and then what do? You go out and you start like lining up interviews, or and simultaneously looking for archival footage, or what?
Well, you get the money. You have to get the money. That's actually, I think, in some ways, the biggest hurdle. And I can't credit myself at all for that. I wasn't part of fundraising. Mark Akbar is the executive producer, and then there was a variety of other producers. So, and then Joel Backen also created the original treatments and did a lot of the pitching to broadcasters, et cetera, et cetera. So they spent about 3 years putting the funds together to make the film. But once that's in place, I mean, I shouldn't be too flippant about that. Obviously, the film has to be made, and that's, and without question, this was the, I mean, I can't really envision a bigger project in terms of making a film, because the content was so ambitious, and we really had very, very high hopes for what the outcome of the film would be. And it did take 3 years to make. That would be about a year exclusively shooting, and then a year and a half in editing, and there's quite a bit of overlap, too. I mean, we were shooting right until we locked picture, basically. No small project, that's for sure.
Yeah, I would imagine once you began to undertake this project, there would be quite a bit of weight on your shoulders to pull off a good film because of its importance.
Yeah, I think that that we all feel a great deal of responsibility putting a film like this out. But that's why we do it, and that's what, you know, I think you do face so many hurdles as a documentary filmmaker in society. You know, you just have to jump one hurdle after the next daily, basically, to pull a film together. And I think that to have the staying power, you have to be motivated by really believing in the project. And I think that was vital to every contributor in for the film.
Maybe you could tell us about some more of those hurdles. First off, could a film like this, do you think it could be produced in the U.S., or was it, you know, pretty much it had to happen in Canada?
Well, people ask us that question, and of course we don't really know, but I think that there is something to say about being an outsider. I mean, of course we have corporations in Canada, but you know, the headquarters of most, many of the biggest transnationals are in the United States, and all, and also the American model of the corporation is dominating the world. So, you know, to be Canadian and to have that vantage point, which is outside, I do think is helpful. Funding-wise, we do have different funding structures in Canada, and it's not easy to raise the money, that's for sure. But I do think it's probably a little bit easier, especially for a subject matter like this.
Maybe if we could bounce back to a couple of the people you interviewed. All of them are intriguing. It's hard to pick, you know, who to specifically narrow down on. But one of them that stuck out in my mind was the Sir Mark Moody Stuart, who is the former chairman of Royal Dutch Shell. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about him. He's really intriguing on a lot of different levels.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very important to us that we not demonize corporate insiders. We examine the institution of the corporation. We're not saying anything generally about the people inside corporations. They are diverse, just as diverse as any other sector of the population. Maybe not just as, but I mean, there's a certain demographic there for sure. Sir Mark Moody Stuart, very, very genuine man who sincerely seems to care about many of the issues that protesters care about, you know, the environment and workers, etc., and is really willing to have a dialogue with people about this. We have one, actually, clip of him, which is one of my favorite clips in the film, where he recounts a story of protesters coming to his house and hanging a murderer's sign across his house. And he and his wife start talking to the protesters, and they end up sitting down and having coffee on his lawn. Now, when we first, you know, had that clip in the interview, we said, okay, we've got to get footage of this protest. Does it exist? And we actually weren't even going to use the story if we couldn't get the footage. And our extraordinary researcher did find the footage. And I think it shows a very different side to a CEO than one might have in their imagination if they're not familiar with corporate culture. Very human person, a very sincere person, but at the same time, one who was not able to change the corporation that he ostensibly controlled in terms of its environmental effect or in terms of what happened in Nigeria. So I think that speaks to the fact that the corporation has a legal mandate as a structure that decision makers have to work within, and that they don't, you know, because of that, they aren't able to necessarily implement their or see their personal values in action.
And then another person that figures prominently into your film is Ray Anderson.
Right. Yes. He's the CEO of the largest commercial carpet manufacturer. We actually got that interview very late in the game. Mark saw an article in the paper where he says, in the future, people like me will be in jail for basically polluting the earth. So we said, oh my God, we have to get this guy. And Mark interviewed him. And when I saw the interview, I went, oh my God, I have been waiting for this interview. He, you know, talks about having an epiphany, you know, 21 years after founding his company, realizing that he hadn't given a thought to the environment in the process of making his products. And so he totally has shifted the paradigm that his corporation operates under and has the goal of being sustainable, that is, having no environmental footprint by the year 2020. And, you know, he has I say Jimmy Carter accent, but I don't know American accents that well. He seems that way to me, but very sort of charismatic character that many people feel he's the star of the film. He came to Sundance with us and was given a standing ovation. But a very inspirational man. And he's different than other corporate insiders who talk about social responsibility. And to me, this is what sets him apart. He actually says, you know, if we can't make carpet sustainably, maybe we don't have a place in this world. So, you know, he's willing to, you know, say, okay, if we can't do it, then we won't, which is pretty radical.
Yeah, and very inspiring. And the film deals a lot with, obviously, the bad aspects of corporations, which are numerous. But then at the end, you do start showing where people are affecting changes for the better. Can you talk about some of those?
Sure. We sample. I mean, there's so many things around the world that are happening to fight corporate rule and corporate power and to regain our democracy, reclaim our democracies and citizenship. And so we've just sampled a few stories. For example, a small Arcata town in California was one that attempted to rein in the power of corporations in their municipal government and had a series of town meetings wherein, you know, I think the result was perhaps disappointing in terms of what they actually accomplished, but which was that they limited the number of chain restaurants that they had in their town and permit no more. But it's an example of a municipality trying to have much more control as citizens about what's going on in their communities as it relates to corporate influence. Another example would be the corporate charter revocation movement, which is a movement, I think it's based in the United States. Our example is from the United States. I suspect it's probably happening elsewhere. But it's an example of a group of people who are trying to get the Attorney General of this California, to revoke the corporate charter of Unical for repeat environmental and human rights offenses. I mean, the Attorney General does have the power to revoke corporate charters. And they actually, ironically, it happens all the time. But it happens when corporations don't pay taxes. It doesn't happen when they commit horrendous crimes. So that's one example. Another example is the corporate charter revocation movement.
You had mentioned earlier one of your favorite clips. I'm wondering what other, since you were the editor, what other clips really stand out in your mind as your personal favorites?
I really do relate to the sections with Ray Anderson, and because I am, you know, I consider myself an environmentalist, and I'm very, very, it was very important to me that those issues be represented, both in terms of how corporations are affecting the natural world, as well as non-human animals. And so Ray Anderson's sections are, you know, really important for me. The Oscar Oliveri and story around Bolivia and the way that that country kicked Bechtel out after they were given a contract to privatize the water there. I find that to be a very inspirational story about society who just said, enough, we're not going to take this anymore. We are not going to allow a corporation to control our water such that we suffer such tremendous consequences. And those people risked their lives, and some people did lose their lives, and some people are maimed for life as a result. Maybe, I think, a very courageous struggle. So that's another of my favorite sections.
Yeah, I think that, though I'd heard of that before, I'd never seen it, and your film brought that, you know, before our eyes. So, as with so many other things, it's an amazing film. You know, you're just, I can't recommend it enough. What's your vision for where this is going to go? Do you see it potentially being integrated into schools?
Well, actually, that's already happening. I mean, I'll just say I'm totally blown away already by what the reception to our film. I'm shocked and honored. And it has, for example, Canada's largest business school is developing an entire course around the film. So it's introducing, you know, so it's a course about business ethics. But, you know, we... Originally, the film was a three-hour television series, and it has been broadcast in Canada, and we do have international broadcast licenses. And we all, you know, we always saw it as one feature-length film, probably because Mark and I are both feature documentary makers. But, you know, you just can hope that a film will have the kind of box office success, or even that it will get theatrical release. You know, documentaries don't frequently get theatrical release. And, you know, you can't ever predict how that's going to transpire. What, at this point in time, we are being billed as the most successful documentary in Canadian history in terms of box office sales. We opened in Vancouver and Toronto on January 16th. It was supposed to start for a week, and then they were, you know, you would see how we were doing. Well, we're still in Vancouver 5 months later. So, and I believe we might even be in Toronto, and we're also in a variety of other cities, but it's really quite amazing to us that it's being received so well. And I think it's not only the film, it's that these issues resonate for people. People are very, very concerned about these issues, and not only a particular kind of person, but it seems to be across generations, across political ideologies and parties. You know, and it's it's very gratifying.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, the timing couldn't have been better.
No, it's very good timing. Not only about the subject matter, but also I think people are craving more in-depth analysis than what they're receiving in the news and, say, in fiction films. You know, they're craving just the popularity of documentary right now is certainly good for us.
Well, unfortunately, we are pretty much out of time. We've been talking with Jennifer Abbott. She is co-director and editor of the new film, The Corporation. Thank you for coming in, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for your interest.